I invite you to be finding Philippians chapter 4 this morning. Philippians chapter 4, the first 8 or 9 verses will be our text. If you've been around here long, you know that Philippians is my favorite book of the Bible, and chapter 4 of Philippians is my favorite chapter of the Bible. I try to return there at least once every year, and I've just been led to this passage again for our thoughts this morning. As Paul wrote the letter to the Philippians, he was at risk for any number of mental and emotional illnesses. In fact, taking what we know today about risk factors for mental and emotional illness, and taking what we know about Paul's life and putting those side by side, we could easily say that Paul would have been in the high risk category for a number of mental, emotional illnesses. Now, this is not an exhaustive list, but just think about some of the things that Paul was dealing with as he wrote this letter. Number one, he was dealing with guilt. Paul could look back on his life and he could reflect on terrible mistakes. He could reflect on terrible errors of judgment, or, as he called them, sins. Most notable to us would be that period in Paul's life when he was persecuting, when he was trying to put to death the church of Christ. And that time when he was participating in violence and even murder against Christians. Paul would struggle with that guilt so much that he would call himself the chief of sinners. He would write in Romans chapter 7 about his struggle to do what he knew was right and how often he fell short of meeting God's standard. And that guilt would put him at risk of all sorts of neuroses and other mental health issues. Not only, though, was Paul dealing with guilt as he wrote this letter, he was dealing with glory. As you know, when Paul was converted, he went on to become the greatest preacher and the greatest missionary in the known world. And Paul could have been proud, too proud, of this status. He could have thought about all the conversions and all the baptisms and all the churches and all the cities that he had planted, all of the success that he had had in mission work and ministry. And he could have become narcissistic, which is a mental and emotional health issue that many who are rich and famous and popular have to deal with. That their view of themselves becomes so inflated that they become impossible to deal with. Paul was at risk of that. And not only was there guilt and glory in his past and present, but there was also a lot of grievance. Paul, as he wrote this letter, could have felt grieved by the way he had been treated by other people. Paul was hated and hunted and hounded like no other person on the planet. Paul had been attacked over and over again, both verbally and physically. Even Christians attacked his reputation and tried to destroy his influence and his ministry. He had been physically attacked on many occasions, beaten, stoned, and left for dead, chased. And Paul could have been a wonderful candidate for such mental and emotional illnesses such as post-traumatic stress, anxiety, depression, even schizophrenia, and many others. And so Paul was in the high risk category, we would say, for mental and emotional illness. He was missing a good chance to be emotionally ill. And yet he writes this letter. This letter that is so full of joy and hope and optimism and peace. Do you know that 19 times in these four chapters of Philippians, Paul mentions some form of the word joy? 13% of the verses in this book mention joy. And so as you're reading, that means on average, every 10th verse, you'd come to the idea of joy. And not only is joy in here, but Paul talks about the peace that passes all understanding. Paul talks about contentment. He says, I have learned to be content no matter my circumstances. And our question is this: how could Paul be experiencing everything that he had experienced and write with that kind of joy and optimism? Well, he lays out the answer, I believe, here in chapter 4. And I call it the Philippian prescription for spiritual, mental, and emotional health. And I want to just name about five parts of this prescription this morning. We'll touch on these lightly, and we'll allow you to pick out the ones that feel most relevant and important to you. But let me mention five. The Philippian prescription for spiritual, physical, emotional health. Number one, relate to God's people. If you want to be spiritually, mentally, emotionally healthy, then have good relationships with people. Look at verse 1 if you're in the text with us in Philippians 4. Paul says, therefore, my brothers and sisters, you whom I love and long for, my joy and crown. Does it sound like he's close to them? Stand firm in the Lord in this way, dear friends. Now look at verse 2. I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, my true companion, help these women, since they have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my co-workers, whose names are in the book of life. Now, these are two women that Paul mentions in verse 2, and they are prominent women, apparently, in the church in Philippi. We don't know exactly why they are prominent. It could be that they are wealthy and that their homes were of a sufficient size that they could support a congregation meeting in their home. That's how churches met usually in the first century. So that could be it. There might have been a church meeting in these women's homes. But they were having a feud. That feud became public. They weren't getting along, and Paul says, you folks need to figure out how to get along. He asked his true yoke fellow, a companion in ministry that he had there in Philippi, help them work this out. They're going to need to start getting along with one another. Mentally healthy people are good at relationships. And if they aren't good at relationships, they will work to get better at relationships. One of the most key markers of mental and emotional health is being close and intimate in your relationships with other people. You have an earthly family. You have a faith family. Get close to them. Now, I know that's not easy. I know it's not. There's a poem that I often quote from this pulpit. To dwell above with saints we love, oh, won't that be glory? But to dwell below with saints we know, now that's another story. And isn't that true? I know it's hard. But we've got to find a way to take our earthly family, our faith family, our close friends, and be close and intimate and have healthy relationships with them. We must be willing to give and forgive, and sometimes give in, but never give up on relationships if we're going to be healthy emotionally. Relate to God's people. Number two, recognize God's presence. Recognize God's presence. We pick up in our text in verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Now, I want you to remember something. Paul is not writing this letter from a luxurious hotel on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. He is writing this letter from a Roman prison cell where he is confined. He doesn't know if or when he'll be released. He knows he may very well be executed. And yet this letter is so full of positivity, we expect him somewhere along the way to pause and say, "Wish you were here." Again, how is he so positive in those circumstances? I think the key is found there in verse 5, the B part that we just read, or at least one key. He said, "The Lord is near. The Lord is right here with me. The Lord is close. The Lord is right beside me. They can lock me in this prison, but they can't lock him out. And if he is here with me, beside me, in me, then I have fullness of joy. And I look around at this prison and say, this feels like a palace to me. Because God is here with me." If you don't have joy in your life, it's because the presence of God doesn't feel real to you. Listen to David. Psalm 16:11, talking to God, "In your presence is fullness of joy." In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand, he continues, are pleasures forevermore. For spiritual, mental, and emotional health, learn to practice the presence of God. Donald and Simi Godwin took their 4-year-old grandson on a camping trip at Lake Superior. A thunderstorm came and lightning was everywhere, and they were rushing to get under some cover, but when lightning would flash, that little 4-year-old would turn and face the lightning, face the flashes, and he would put on his best smile. And they said, "What are you doing?" He said, "God's taking my picture." He taught him a theology lesson, didn't he? Do you see God everywhere? Do you see God in nature? He's there. Do you see God in the storm? He's there. Do you see God in your situations, in your circumstances? He's there. Do you see God in the decisions that you have to make? He's there, willing to help you make the right one and the best one. Do you see him? Just pause on a regular basis throughout the day and remind yourself, God is near. God is here. And if he is with me, it is okay. Number 3, reflect God's patience. We find that in a verse that we just read, verse 5, where Paul says, "Let your gentleness be evident to all." Now, that word gentleness is difficult to translate, and translators do their best, but you get a lot of different varieties about what commentators think the word means. But among the suggestions, yielding, kind, forbearing, lenient. Those are some of the words commentators use to try to express in English what this Greek word that we translate gentleness means. Or to state it in the negative, we could say, don't be impatient and don't be someone who's given to anger. God is patient with us, 2 Peter 3:9. And then God says, now you go out and you treat others the way I'm treating you. I'm patient with you. You be patient with others. You have that long fuse. Folks, anger is harmful to our mental and our physical and our spiritual health. Do you know that a person, for example, who is given to frequent anger is just as likely to have a heart attack as someone who has high blood pressure or high cholesterol, someone who smokes, someone who is out of shape? We are just at risk if we are given to frequent anger. I read sometime back about a Canadian that became angry with Canada's Attorney General. Gil Remillard was the Attorney General's name. They'd had a dispute, and the man had just for month after month after month written and complained and tried to get a meeting and on and on. And finally, this man became so upset that he took an axe and he cut off his own finger and he mailed it to the Attorney General through the mail. And you say, well, that's extreme, but is it? I know you probably wouldn't go to that length, but who in here hasn't hurt himself, herself, because you're angry with somebody else? Who in here has not held that hot coal in his hand waiting for a good chance to throw it at your enemy? I have. Some of us are doing it now. And Paul says, no, you gotta be gentle, yielding, forgiving, forbearing. You gotta have that long fuse if you're gonna be mentally and emotionally, spiritually healthy. Paul says, of course, in Ephesians 4, be angry and sin not. And that means that anger is not always a sin, but man, does it lead us into sin so often, doesn't it? Somebody said, when you fly off the handle, it's hard to make a good landing. And it is. What the Bible says, though, is that sudden anger ought to be controlled, and that sinful anger that is turns into bitterness and resentment, that ought to be confessed. And then sanctified anger, righteous anger, should be channeled into something positive and something good. And so we are to reflect God's patience. God is patient toward us, and we ought to be patient with other people if we're going to be healthy. Number four, rely on God's power. If you're in the text, look at verse 6. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds. Sounds like mental health, doesn't it? Will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. One of the most damaging things that you can do for your mind and body is worry. Worry is sand in the machinery of the mind. Now, we're not saying don't be concerned about things. We aren't saying that it's wrong to look to tomorrow and get prepared and get ready and do what you can. But to worry, to stew, to be anxious is hard on your body and it's hard on your mind. That word anxious here means to choke or to tear apart. Can't worry do that to you? Remember that old punishment? That old means of execution being tied and quartered. Young people might not know what that is, but that was a thing. And they would actually take your limbs, your arms and your legs, and put ropes on them and bind you that way. And four horses would get a hold of each of those, and they would go in separate directions and just pull your body apart. And Paul says that's what anxiety is. It chokes you or it tears you apart. Over here you got faith in God that says it's going to be okay. Over here you got doubt. I don't know if it's going to be okay. I don't know if God has got this or not. And they just pull you until mentally and emotionally you want to come apart. And some do. Had an opportunity several years ago. I was sent by the school system to do a seminar with Dr. Joseph Shannon. He practices psychiatry in Columbus, Ohio, and he was one of the world's experts in self-harm in young people who cut and harm themselves and how to help them and how to prevent that self-harm. Such a brilliant man, but he had really such a simple counseling strategy. He says, anytime a person brings a problem to me, the first thing we do is make a decision on the problem. He says, there's just two categories. Can you do something about this, or can you not do anything about this? Those are the only two categories. He says, if we decide that they can do something about this, then we decide what's the best thing to do. We make the plan, and I encourage them, go do something about this. And if it's in that category where they can't do anything about it, then they start working on ways to accept, coping strategies, ways to let it go. As someone has written, for every problem under the sun, there is either a cure or there is none. If there is none, never mind it. If there is one, seek until you find it. That's what Dr. Shannon says. And Paul says, don't be anxious about anything, but pray about everything. Did you notice we get the antidote? Paul doesn't just say, hey, anxiety is a problem. Don't let it rip you apart. Don't let it choke you. He says, no, here's the antidote. Pray. Are you concerned about things? Yes, but don't be pulled apart by anything. You've got stress. Don't let it turn into distress because you're giving it to God in prayer. Notice Paul says, in everything, pray. Don't get the idea that something is too small to pray to God about it. If it is important to you, it is important to God. I read about a missionary who was kind of out in the wild, in the jungle, doing his work. And man, he was exhausted. He wasn't sleeping well. There was a lion roaming around the village, and they all knew it. And he was worried. And so he wasn't getting any sleep, wasn't getting any rest. One night he crawled into his tent, and he said, Lord, deliver me from fear, from that lion tonight, and help me get some rest. I need it. But inside that tent, there was a little mosquito just flying around all night, and it would land and it would buzz and it would go by his ear. And, you know, it kept him up all night. And the next morning he said, you know, it was almost like the Lord said to me, you asked me for help with that lion, but you thought you could handle that mosquito all by yourself, didn't you? And you say, well, I don't want to bother God with the little stuff. He's got a whole lot going on. Let me ask you something. You think anything's big for God? You can pray about everything. I've been trying to practice this recently as I've been having this text on my mind. What I hate about school more than anything is cafeteria duty. I go in and I watch the fifth graders eat lunch every day, and I have to supervise. There's about 100 fifth graders, and the energy is up to here, and the noise, and the commotion. And for a little introvert like me, I'm a sensitive person by nature. I don't like commotion. I don't like noise, and it is a mess of stress in there for me. I hate it. And just several days ago, I started thinking, why do I not pray before I go in there? Why have I never prayed before I go do lunch duty? And so I said, I'm going to do an experiment. I'm going to start praying about this before I go in there. Jerry Wayne said something in my class recently that kind of got that on my mind. I'm going to pray before I go in there. I'm going to pray that the Lord, through His Spirit, will just saturate that room, and He will affect everybody in there, and He'll cause us all to want to be calm and controlled and compliant and cooperative, more so than we would be on our own. And before I go in there, I'll say, Lord, either change that cafeteria for me or change me for that cafeteria, but I need some help. And would it surprise anybody to know that things are better since then? Not perfect, of course. And to be honest, I think more days God changes me for the cafeteria. But that's okay. We can pray about anything. We can pray about everything. And it is the antidote to anxiety. Rely on God's power. Finally, rehearse God's principles. If you're in the text, let's finish by looking at verse 8. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Whatever you've learned or received or heard from me, says Paul, or seen in me, put it into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. For good mental, emotional, spiritual health, fill your mind with good things and do it on purpose. And you say, well, yeah, but, you know, negative thoughts just pop in my mind. I can't stop that. And you're right. But have you heard that old saying, you can't keep a bird from flying over your head, but you can keep it from making a nest in your hair? Yes, negative thoughts are going to come, but if you will, on purpose, fill your mind with good things. Here's a list that you can choose from. You can just stop. If you're having negative thoughts, then you just stop and you say, hey, what's something that's true? Let me make a list in my mind of things that are true and I can count on. I know the news is awful, but what's noble? Let me think about something that's noble. What's right? What's pure? What's lovely? Let me focus my mind on that. And God gives us this wonderful blessing that my mind cannot focus on two things at once. Two things at the same time cannot be the center of my focus. And so if I put something right or good or pure or praiseworthy on my mind, then the bad is just locked out. Can't get in. At least it can't get to the forefront of my attention. So we fill our minds with good thoughts. I was reading about two twins, and just from birth, one of them was a pessimist to the nth degree, and one was an optimist to the nth degree. The parents started talking, I wonder if we could do something to kind of change their personalities and make them swap. And so they decided to do something one Christmas. They were going to take that pessimistic child and they were going to buy him a room full of the very best toys that money could buy. And I mean, stack them to the ceiling in that room. The optimistic boy, they were going to lead out to the barn and point to a big stall of manure and say, that's your Christmas present. Christmas morning comes. They lead that pessimistic child into that room full of toys, and he looks at them and frowns and says, well, they'll tear up and be useless in no time. And they lead that optimistic child out to the barn, and he looks at all that manure, and he says, oh, boy, with all this manure, there's got to be a pony around somewhere. Folks, mental, emotional, spiritual health is not about your position. It's about your disposition. And if you will absorb what Paul has to say here in this letter, and of course what the other authors in the Bible say as well, you can have a disposition of joy and peace and contentment no matter what's going on around you. Let me remind you as we close that this letter to the Philippians is addressed to all God's holy people in Christ Jesus at Philippi. It's addressed to the church. It's addressed to Christians. These steps that we talked about, this prescription, they're rock solid. They will make a difference for good in your life. I promise you that on the authority of God's word. But these promises are for Christians, for baptized believers. And if I'm not a baptized believer, then I'm locked out of all of these blessings and all of these benefits and, of course, many, many more. The people who can have these blessings are, Paul says, verse 1, in Jesus Christ. How do you get in Jesus Christ? We know, don't we? You're baptized into Christ. You hear the message about him, you believe it. You're willing to confess, I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. You're willing to turn from your former way of life, which is selfish and sinful, and you're willing to turn toward God and say, God, I'll live the way you want now. For the rest of my life, I'll live the way you want. And then you make that commitment official with the public ceremony of baptism where you're baptized into Christ. We invite you to that this morning. We ask that if you're ready to take those steps that you let us know by coming down this aisle as together we stand and sing.